Anaxagoras 12. 18 September 1968. We are concluding the final activities of the research because Howard reports for basic training very soon. Rand continues to harass Griffin. It is intolerably malicious. I have spoken to the chair about her mistreatment. I understand that Rand and Winslow are chiefly responsible for the allegations against me, and that Rand has assumed a role of holy inquisitor for my heresies. But her persecution is unwarranted. I think it is intended to distress me, or to disrupt my research. But it is so hurtful to her. She is thinking she will quit school. I cannot blame her. Unless I am vindicated, they will hound her. By the jeopardy in which they purposely place her, she must choose to betray me, which seems to be the intent of their goading, or to leave the university, which is meant to harm her, and to harm me by the wound I shall have caused her to take for my sake. I cannot let them harm her, if there is anything I can do. The chair, although sympathetic to my feelings and upset by the injustice to Griffin, seems to feel helpless, out of intimidating fears. I cannot say what she fears. Rand has an imperious demeanor, and he is well connected within the regions of the university, and I know she owes her position to his influence, it is true. But I had believed in her integrity, until these events proved her cowardly and untrue to her avowed convictions and the faithless homilies which dribble from her mouth. Forgive me this unkindness, but some people are just as they appear to be, and no more. Howard is home with his family and will return to us just before he must leave to be with Zoe. I'm glad to give a sanctuary for their love. Griffin is assisting me to index our notes and file results and summarize findings in preparation of the first draft of the Chimera study. Howard feels cheated that he will not participate, but I have promised to send the drafts for his comments and edits. Alice, Caterpillar, and Cheshire Cat are remaining to help and still occasionally volunteer for observations. Alice undertook an observation with intent to try another intentional travel. It was not one that could be validated, and so may have only anecdotal value, such as the narrative data collected in our initial survey. We have therefore also foregone the biometric readings. Alice's reported exomatic episode was not very long, but was quite intense for her. She did report at its conclusion its duration by clocks as approximately 14 minutes, but said it seemed a passage of hours. She said she wanted to find her father. She had never known him. She knew nothing of him. She had his name. She had understood as a child that he was a jazz musician, a saxophone player whom her mother had met in Memphis. She channeled upon the feelings of such a place, she said, having been reminded of it by a Southside jazz club we had visited last January. Howard and I had taken her to hear Roland Kirk. She'd been speechless. She had looked quite entranced. The novel experience and Mr. Kirk's antic sax, I thought, had been the cause of the effect on her, but she told me now that no, it was rather a kind of vicarious memory, like the experience of someone else which she remembered, her mother's or her father's, that she had felt in the atmosphere of the place, in the crazy abstraction of his frenetic melody that she heard, that moved liquid in midair like Jackson Pollock, tangling wet loops and spills in colors that were animals alive, dancing like eels, like her mother danced. So channeling this, This memory of another person, guided by its indefinable feeling alone, she took a flight on intention out of her body into distances of past or present or future, she knew not where, to see if she may, to see her father there. When I asked what she found, she said she believed he must be gone for good, and that only traces of his being were found, like stubbed out cigarettes left in ashtrays, and broken bottles, and unpaid late bills, and empty envelopes with canceled postage marks, carrying letters from people she had never heard of. He was gone. She had felt him. She had smelled the room where he lived, but it was a stale smell, and he had gone. There's nothing to make of this but narrative for its own sake. It may be no more than lucid dreaming, but Alice felt it was meaningful. She was no longer angry with him for having left her, she said, and remembered then it was her mother's anger that she must have engaged, that as a child she had felt nothing but sadness and missing him. And though she could not remember his face, she could remember now his hands, long-fingered lovely hands, freckled like her own. 28 September 1968. Caterpillar and Cheshire Cat are returning to their apartment tomorrow. Griffin has long since moved back with Hedgehog and Mock Turtle, of course, although how long she may stay with him is uncertain. Only Zoe is left with me come Monday. Howard took the train from Union Station this morning east to Washington, D.C., and there to some boot camp somewhere. He gave me his address, but I do not want to look at it. It is not here, and he's not here. I'm grateful to the intentions and accidents of my life that I have known him. But I do hate these partings for war. This day of all days. 28 October 1968. 1 month since Howard left. Zoe is moving home to be with her mother on the 1st of November. I have gotten so used to her companionship, I think I shall feel quite lonesome for a time. I'm not used to such a quiet house. Just Bugger and me again. Last night we completed our last experiment in the observation room. The girls had come over for a celebratory supper together. We toasted ourselves with some wine, but decided to save the cocktails until the experiment had been finished and the room put away for good. Griffin monitored the instruments while I wrote the narrative. White Rabbit, Cheshire Cat, and Caterpillar all came to watch. Alice took on the last task. We had fully completed the regimen that we had intended. So many events having intervened and interrupted, this attempt then would be made in this last observation to practice a telekinetic episode. Alice volunteered to be our subject, and although she had the least experience with such a variance and exomatic experience, we all agreed upon it, feeling as she did, that she possessed an extraordinary motivation under the circumstance. A proposal was made that the subject should take some message to Howard, who would be told to expect it by cable that I would send in advance. He should receive it in his ordinary evening mail call, and the subject would induce the state some time after that. Alice felt assured of herself. After the electrodes were attached, the edge of her transition into theta was almost immediate. Griffin was hardly out of the observation room, and a profound, energetic gamma phase began. She was gone for nearly 35 minutes. In the signature event, she leapt out of gamma into a fully alert beta and immediately began talking to us from the observation room and moving the electrodes from her body, which of course she was not supposed to do, but this experiment should be an appendix to the body of our study at any rate. She was the excited child I most fondly remember, effusive, rapidly chattering, mind leaping, racing, tumbling like little kittens at play. She had seen him, she exclaimed, eyes teary but joyful. She had played a delicious joke on him. She would not tell us what. We would find out. And indeed, this morning, feeling besmirched and bewildered from the sanguinary stupor of too many cocktails and too long night's course of memories and conversation, I had gone to the door in my nightie to answer the ringing doorbell, and Zoe made everyone get up too and gather about me in their nightgowns, out in the garden, with the solace of a hot cup of strong tea to brace and waken and soothe them, while I should read out loud at once, to all of them together, the Western Union cable I had just received. Josephine Baker, care of Edith Casey, 3232 South Kenwood Avenue, Chicago, Illinois, found your kiss on my pillow. Stop. Wish I could have kissed you back. Stop. I love you. Stop. Howard Nussbaum, APO, and a bunch of numbers. Zoe giggled and hugged me and hugged the other girls, and none of us completely understood until she explained that she had deliberately put on lipstick, which was true, I had seen it, and she does not usually wear lipstick, but then she does not usually do anything predictably. So I had not thought it odd that it was odd. So when she kissed his pillow next to where his head lay in bed, she left a mark of her lips on the pillowcase beside him. He had found it. 5 November 1968. Griffin came over to watch the election returns with Hawthorne and me. She asked if she could come back and live with me. She said she felt she could not live with Hedgehog and Mock Turtle anymore. She did not explain, but said that they were spying on her, she felt. They were wheedling her for information about me and reporting it to Dr. Rand, she believed. That seemed implausible to me, though Hawthorne cautioned me not to be so sure, but of course I said yes to her. I really have come to enjoy living in a community of women, and I missed her company. We had a nice dinner. I told them the latest that I had heard from Zoe, and Hawthorne entertained us with gossip about my own department, which of course I should never hear. The election was not decided until a little after 2 in the morning. We stayed up late to watch it, like a bad movie we just wanted to see end. Nixon took Illinois, and that is what decided it. The daily political machine in my own Chicago either failed or betrayed Humphrey in the end, it was suggested. And it is true, Daley shares the political vision of President-elect Nixon. God help us. The South went to Wallace. Racist segregationists have not given up. Perhaps they will never give up. I do not know what will happen now. The war will certainly continue. Bombing of the North has been momentarily suspended, but who knows for how long. Howard will ship out in May after corpsman training.
Your Majesty, members of the jury, loyal subjects, and the king. The prisoner at the bar is charged with enticing Her Majesty, the Queen of Hearts, into a game of croquet and thereby willfully and with malice aforethought teasing, tormenting, and otherwise annoying our beloved...
Never mind all that. Get to the part where I lose my temper.
Thereby causing the queen to lose her temper.
Now, are you ready for your sentence?
Sentence? But there must be a verdict first.
Sentence first. Verdict afterwards.
But that just isn't the way.
Always on.
Your ways, Your Majesty.
Yes, my child. Off with her!
Consider, my dear, we've called no witnesses. Couldn't we hear maybe one or two? Huh? Maybe?
Oh, very well. But get on with it!
First witness.
This is the last of Edith's diaries that I shall quote, which are germane to her trial. I shall explain the matter in my own words as I witnessed it. She herself did not report the matter in her diary in any event. In fact, she would give up the diaries entirely after the new year. In its issue for Thanksgiving in America in 1968, Time, the news magazine, would dryly comment on President Johnson's patriotic proclamation for the festivity of our annual national turkey slaughter, declaring it to be gratuitous and glossy, like a giant Sears catalog of the country's virtues and material possessions. Time would tell, quote, "Looking at the sunset from a Los Angeles freeway refracted through smog and windshield, Los Angeles Times columnist Jack Smith wondered what a man from an earlier century might have felt if he had sat beside him in the automobile. A rational man, like Dr. Johnson, must surely see that the species had at last given up its glimmer of sanity and was annihilating itself in this magnificent, psychotic Gotterdammerung." 1968 would be the watershed of our politics and society, people would say. America would be one nation before it and another nation after it. Pat Buchanan would say that culture war was declared that year. A total war for victory. We must die for our beliefs. We must kill for our beliefs. We are in the time of the apocalypse. The children who have been born since then, whom I have seen in my classes, I have seen changed. They live in a perpetual state of petulant, self-made, melodramatic crises, while our most terrible perils are ignored. Fear has so frightened us that what we should fear cannot be looked at for the terror of our lives. Our children are pale and pathetic, kept inside in the air-conditioned shadows of cultural despair. Desperation is a strong emotion, too strong an emotion for these inured by nihilism or benumbed by complacence and electronic dreaming. It is an emotion requiring awareness of the helplessness with which we are too frightened to cope. Yes, our desperation is too much to acknowledge in our society, and so we cannot act. Where once confrontations quickened us to combat morally, we have now withdrawn to hiding places, and we have left the field of battle to fanatical zealots who would destroy the world in order to save it. On November 28, as I sat on her sofa thumbing Time magazine, oblivious to my future, I was apprehensive for Edith's, who was happily basting her turkey with buttery gravy, while Griffin fussed with the autumnal table centerpiece. Neither felt the apprehensions I had, but were quietly and serenely resigned and resolved. The day before, Summoned to the chair's office, she had been informed that the investigations had concluded and charges had been preferred against her, proposing the termination of her tenure and her removal from the university. The official stationery lay on the coffee table before me. I had set it down after Edith had shown it to me. I should become very familiar with its allegations. The record shall show complaints concerning Dr. Casey's professional conduct since as early as 1965 and continuing and increasing thence. There are complaints about Dr. Casey's performance by her students, her colleagues, and others. The complaints concern poor teaching, absence from class, absences from faculty meetings, low enrollment in her classes, facilitating unbecoming conduct of students, harboring criminal conspirators, sedition, obscenity, indecency, promoting promiscuity and sexual perversion, undocumented research, improper methodology, unscientific inquiry, and other matters. She was suspended from her duties and given an indefinite administrative leave of absence. Her lab and her office were sealed and the locks were changed. There would be an official trial of the Faculty Senate in January. She would be permitted to confront her accusers, Edith declared. They would be permitted to slander and slur, I told her. She offered me dark or light meat from the salver. I could not persuade her how serious the matter was. I think even then she had passed a threshold of profound alteration, and they could not hurt her any more. Prescient, patient Edith foretold me my pending purgatory, that I should not see her again until the trial, that then I should not be able to acknowledge my affection for her, but must be distant and restrained. I had no idea what she meant by her eerie prophecy. It had the creepy, crawly feeling of a horror movie when she said it, and Griffin looked at me with the same sincere, serene sympathy for the apparent curse to which I had been assigned. Her gin and tonics accumulated upon my head and body, and soon I passed through a threshold beyond which I should not be heard, or at least for a little while, and we spoke no more about the matter that evening. The dean solicited my membership to the trial committee the following Monday. I should have thought my relationship with Edith was well known, but Dr. Rand himself had recommended me, and I should not have refused in any event. If I might persuade others of her innocence, I should try. And when subsequently I learned I should be obliged to cull her papers for guilt, I was happy to be subversive to their evil plans. I thought foolishly that Doctors Rand and Winslow and their slimy cabal of wormy insinuators might be duped. But what I found in her journals, as I have selected for you, would be used to further his indictment rather than to exonerate her as I had intended. In the end, I was just another stupid fly caught in the sticky web of deceit wherein Rand, the fat spider, sat, centered, and salivating for his ripening supper. I could not wait to take up my mission, but I found that my efforts immediately were frustrated. The papers of her research had been previously removed by Dr. Rand and had been placed under lock in an anteroom of the chair to which only he had the key. This cranny became a kind of evidence room for the prosecution, and I was forbidden access to it. Now, you should not be misinformed by the poetic use of my dramatic references. You should know that officially and technically, in consonance with the tradition of academe, and the liberty of academic thought, that there is no such thing as a prosecutor per se in a trial before a faculty senate, but there is a presenter of fact. Just so, there is no such thing as a jury, but there is a finder of fact. And there is no judge, but there is a determiner of fact, who shall concur upon the finding of fact. Essentially, facts presented are facts found, and facts found are facts determined. And judgment shall be made upon facts as they are determined. Essentially, what is fact is not refutable. Only confession mitigates findings of fact. When accused, only contrition exonerates. You must admit to error in order to be freed of error. This is the most ancient and effective method to know the truth. The accused who drowns is innocent. She who survives should be put to death. The only portion left to my fact-finding, then, were the journals. The ancient ones which Edith had kept separately in her office. The recent volumes which she had kept in her home. Edith freely gave me access to these, delivering the volume for 1968 to me, soon after the year ended. Eventually, she made a personal gift of them all to me, because I cherished them so. These journals were apparently unknown or unnoticed or unimportant to Rand, and had been at any rate separated from the relevant files and research papers. Although they contained much cogent interpretation of that research, and revealed very tellingly the climb of her thinking, as I am sure you shall have observed. Being denied the access to the evidence room, I also did not know directly of the Star Chamber witnesses. But they were disclosed by Winslow carelessly at a luncheon, for the finders of fact, to be introduced to one another. The seven good men, or women, and true, who had been selected to serve. I should have thought Winslow should also be considered too biased to participate, as myself. But let us remember that first of all we were surely academes who were sworn allegiance to truth, whose perseverance for fact made our integrity doubtless, and moreover she candidly forswore purchase or knowledge of any illicit allegations against poor Edith, and had only told the truth as she knew it, always, and that she did not discuss the matter with her husband, the prosecutor, I mean to say, presenter of fact, who was at any rate himself entirely selfless and unprejudiced in the affair, and solely concerned for the sovereign interests of our distinguished university and its inimitable department of psychology. At the luncheon, she confided regretfully, with theatric sighs, how much information had been obtained, that we should find the facts too lurid for description, that in addition to information from peers, there was information brought forward from the Chicago police, and official files of the FBI COINTELPRO division. They also had direct testimony from several students who had engaged in the strange, questionable research and had lived in poor Edith's house during the period this past shameful summer. I wanted to slap the bitch. The others, so pathetically I thought, seemed too much affected by her oily, confidential disclosures, and I knew that she schooled many of them privately. And often, a communication that was certainly unethical, if not to be explicitly enjoined by our august procedures. The trial was scheduled post-haste, January 13th. It should be held in the legendary hall of the Tyrannosaurus at the Walker Museum. Then it shall last as many days as it may last. Ah, well, if swift justice is justice not denied, Rand's purpose shall be fulfilled. Off with her head. But the Grand Inquisitor must have felt conflicted between the pleasure of prolonged torture and the satisfaction of summary execution. I think he did not know if he wanted it to end so quickly or no. I scarcely had time to prepare my summaries of the journal, myself also conflicted, seeking evidence of exoneration but enjoying the sheer literary pleasure of her text. I think my students found me completely preoccupied during the week of finals. My grading was generously kind to disguise my inattention. I had no holiday at all. It was the most miserable Christmas of my life, worse than the time I got a BB gun instead of the doll I asked for. And while I spoke to my mom over the phone, it was not the same as being home in Concord, Mass. I promised to come visit as soon as it was all over. I would take time out of my classes. I did attend the psychology department Christmas party, to which I was oddly proffered invitation by Winslow, and which Edith did not attend. It had the atmosphere of a wake. I think everyone there knew what poor baby Jesus really had in store for himself. Still, the eggnog was very good. As Edith had predicted, I did not see her until the first day of the trial. We finders of facts were assembled by a custodial secretary in the windowless hallway behind the heavy double door entry to the hall of the Tyrannosaurus. Dr. Rand's personal assistant told us to line up like a precessional choir for entrance. Meanwhile, she had seated Dr. Casey alone on the solitary chair in the center of this enormous room. Our entrance appeared intentionally delayed. We waited for Dr. Rand. Edith's chair, who would serve as the determiner of fact, was anxiously fidgeting. This hall, I need to explain, was formerly the hall of the skeletal reconstruction of a gigantic Tyrannosaurus rex long since donated to the Smithsonian. During the 1920s, when the hunt for ancient superbones was dernier cri, a vogue lionized by penny-press tabloid journalism at the time, liberally elaborated with sordid tales of steamy jungles, delirious fevers, sweaty pygmies with nose rings, long, slithery, slimy, yellow, poisonous snakes, and more particularly sensational when some of these carnivorous dinosaurs were still alive and very hungry to eat scientists. The paleontology department erected skeletons in this hall. Now, previous to this, and originally, the hall had been dedicated to the physical cultural arts, endowed by breakfast cereal magnat John Harvey Kellogg. It had indeed been built to purpose a gymnasium with leather medicine balls and heavy juggling clubs. The floor has remained, preserved as it was in 1893 when it was refurbished, a glossily, heavily varnished, scuff-proof hardwood that served for indoor badminton and ensemble tumbling and an exercise court. This cavernous room, as a gymnasium should, rose to over 40-foot ceiling, ideal, therefore, for the assembly of giant skeletons, and was circumscribed along the top of it by a running track on a narrow suspended balcony, which can still be accessed through unmarked doors on the foreshortened third floor. The whole of the hall was naturally illuminated by daylight through the huge oval lead glass skylight over the center of it, and through the tiled windows of the paired array of French doors at the back of the hall, through which one could see the snowy lawn on either side of the back wall. A small proscenium stage erected against the back wall for this event. On the temporary proscenium was placed a long table draped in the official maroon and white colors of the university, embroidered with official crest. The scrolled motto read, in Latin, of course, "Let knowledge grow from more to more, and so be human life enriched." A single throne-like, heavy, oaken, high-backed regency chair, official crest carved upon its head, sat beside the table at the precise center. A folding chair was at one end of the table, and a podium with painted crest at the other end. In front of the proscenium were seven folding chairs, proportionately spaced, facing the solitary chair in which Edith sat 20 feet away. Within this enormous cavern, when finally the double doors were swung open, sound resounded, clobbering harshly in the emptiness. Edith half turned in her chair to see us as we entered in single file as instructed, the seven finders at first, with Winslow in the lead, followed by the determiner, the chair, and the transcriber with her machine. And then, after all of these had seated themselves, Dr. Rand came, the presenter of fact, sweeping in briskly, if late, followed by a clattering clutch of high-heeled, eager young female assistants, carrying reams of fluttering papers and stacks of manila folders that they placed on the table on the proscenium near the podium. Rand took the place of his podium, seizing the sides of it with both his hands, and looked toward the chair, who poured herself a goblet of water from a pitcher in front of herself, and sat back in her throne, and nodded at him to begin. Edith laughed. Rand looked at her, was surprised. I tittered a bit myself. But my laughter was nervous, while Edith's laugh was genuinely humored by what she saw. She smiled warmly at Rand, who looked choleric, and at the chair, who looked chagrined, and at the finders of fact, who were all confused, except myself, who smiled back at her, and Winslow, who sneered contemptuously. "This is truly wonderful, Andrew," Edith said, "but I do not see the dish of tarts." She called him Andrew throughout the proceedings, and I realized at once, having at last released my tightly held breath, that I should not feel anxious for her sake as I had felt. I had come to the trial with dread, with a hope to vindicate her, and she had made it clear by her blithe simplicity, by her amusement, by her pleasant acquiescence to the fate solemnly prepared for her, that she had comfortably concluded that she shall not be harmed by it in any manner that mattered to her, and however it should end, it was foregone how it should end, that this officious ceremony was bombast, a gaudy theatrical cloak of strutting, self-conceited ham, to hide the pettiness and the sham of what it is to be done. But like any good theater, it pays to be believed. And if believed, it shall pay, and Edith would certainly pay for it. She did not care, but she should shed the coin that they wanted. And even if she did not care to lose it, still they cared to take it. So it was their victory after all. Though she felt it nothing like defeat, though she felt herself shed of something that had burdened her, though she was free to live as she believed, they felt her defeated, and a certain weight of consequence fell on all of us, like the damage of a storm. But that must yet come to be explained.